The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. It is 2025 and Donald Trump is president once again of the United States. We will, of course, be following the moves of the Donald and his second administration very closely. However, it won't just be politics for us this year. We'll also talk a lot and cover American culture, life, and the arts. I should also remind you, because my producer Natasha will not let me hear the end of it, that we are on Spectator TV. So head to our YouTube channel to watch that. Today we are going to be talking about how Trump 2.0 might change the world in 2025 and beyond. Because on Tuesday, I'm sure many of you will have noticed, Donald Trump gave an extraordinary press conference at Mar-a-Lago, yet another extraordinary press conference at Mar-a-Lago, where he talked, or he reiterated his desire to annex Greenland, Canada, to take back control of the Panama Canal, and also threatened Hamas that all hell will break loose if its Israeli hostages are not returned before his inauguration.
All hell must be paid if they don't release the hostages.
Well, do I have to define it for you? Look, all hell will break out. If those hostages aren't back, I don't want to hurt your negotiation. If they're not back by the time I get into office, all hell will break out in the Middle East. And it will not be good for Hamas, and it will not be good, frankly, for anyone. All hell will break out. I don't have to say anymore, but that's what it is. And they should have given them back a long time. They should have never taken them. There should have never been the attack of October 7th. People forget that.
It was quite a striking moment in world politics, I would say. And I am delighted to be joined by Gideon Rackman of the Financial Times. The Financial Times' chief foreign correspondent. What is your actual title?
Foreign affairs commentator. But foreign anyway, affairs. I can
bet, a very important man. Exactly. A very important man.
That's the key point.
Yep. Gideon Rackman is a very important commentator in world affairs. And we are delighted to be joined by him here the Spectator's office. Gideon, let's start with that press conference. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts about it?
Well, very much like Trump is back, in the sense that it reminded me of what the first term was like, in the sense of these constant surprises. And what? Did he really say that? But then the second thing was that really nobody had seen this coming. I mean, a lot of the discussion of Trump's foreign policy was before the election and during the election was, what will he do about Ukraine? What will he do about China? And how will he resolve the tension between, you know, the neo-isolationists or restrainers who want to kind of pull America back and the primacists, the Mitch McConnell school, who say, no, America, if anything, should be even more assertive in the world. Those were, we thought, the contours of the debate. Mm-hmm. And yet suddenly you've got the focus on America's immediate neighborhood with what sound like outlandish proposals. Greenland, well, you know, he did talk about buying it in the first term, so maybe we should have seen that one coming. But retaking the Panama Canal and Canada turning into the 51st state, These are extraordinary proposals.
And the thing I didn't mention, of course, which is renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America.
Yeah.
But as you say, these are regional concerns for America.
Yeah.
So it is America acting more like a conventional power in some ways, historically, concerned about its neighbourhood.
Yeah, it's kind of 19th century, really. It's saying we intend to dominate our region. We're going to forget about all this stuff about the rules-based order. It's going to be a power-based order. And in that sense, it's more sort of congenial to the Xi Jinping and Putin view of the world, which is we want to dominate our regions. That Putin wants to reestablish Russian influence in Eastern Europe. Xi wants to dominate East Asia. And America is saying, you know what, we're going to dominate our region. And he didn't actually talk in this particular context about Mexico, but you talk to people around Trump and they make very aggressive noises about Mexico, whether it's through because of migration, because of drug production, etc. So you're going to see in America, if he sticks to this, that's really swinging the big stick in its neighborhood.
Well, that gets us on to Trump's America as a revisionist power, which is what you wrote about in an excellent piece you wrote about for the FT recently. But before we get on to that, I just want to ask you a bit about this idea that I've been reading a little bit about in recent days, which is something Dan Hannan suggested on Twitter to Elon Musk, a.k.a. the first buddy, that America, Canada, Britain, Australia, New Zealand could form a sort of free trade Anglosphere alliance with a military element to it. And Elon Musk replied, good idea. Have you, do you sense this is a, is this a sort of Brexiteer fancy?
Well, it's an old idea. I mean, you know, I remember once discussing this in the 1990s with a former owner of The Spectator, Conrad Black, who was pushing the whole idea of the Anglosphere. But, you know, it certainly would be an idea that would be congenial to, you know, a wing of the Conservative Party, but they're not in power right now. If there's a change in power in Canada, which looks like it's coming, you know, maybe they would be more receptive to it. But the trouble is that the way that Trump goes about doing this is so aggressive that even the leader of the... I can never pronounce his last name. Pierre Poilievre, I think, is how he pronounces
it. Poilievre, that's what I was
saying. Poilievre is the French name, but he's got an anglified version of it. But anyway, even he had to say, look, Canada's 51st state, never going to happen. Because, you know, if you're a conservative politician, you stick up for your country. And if your next door neighbor is saying, actually, we're going to, you know, treating you with disrespect and saying, you know, we're going to punish you, we're going to threaten you until you agree to this, it's not a very good way of doing this. So I think the Dan Hannan view would be, in a way, rather old style comedy of English speaking nations. We've got so much in common, history, common law, culture, etc., etc. We're the natural partners rather than this partnership with the EU. And that's an old argument, you know, may have something to it. But the way that Trump's going about it seems to me more like a takeover bid than in a kind of alliance.
Yes, I suppose that is the obvious first tension, that for Brexiteers, it's very attractive, this idea of an Anglo Union to replace the European Union.
Sure.
But Trump's language is very much about America, making America great again. Mm-hmm. It's not about some sort of new world order based on Anglosphere interest.
No, and it was interesting. So I was at a conference in Washington with some of the Trumpy people, and I made an argument that actually values do matter in foreign policy, and almost a Hannan-esque argument that there was not a coincidence that countries like Britain and America had found themselves on the same side. And I got quite a lot of pushback. They said, no, you know, foreign policy is about interests, and what, you know, we're going to stick up for our interests.
Yeah.
And in fact, on my own podcast, when I interviewed Sir Alex Younger, the former head of MI6, he said that over the course of his career, whenever he had felt sort of been tempted by the sentimental view of US-UK relations, he would get a pretty firm reminder that this was about, it's transactional. And that was his view of it.
Yeah, I suppose that's always been the way the commentariat and the special relationship interact, is we forget sometimes that for America, it often is just about interests. And we, because of, for our interests, we would attach a sentimental importance to it that the Americans don't.
I mean, you know, which Americans, of course, you know, it depends. But all countries, to some extent, it's about interests. But obviously, you know, and I think another thing that I think Trump said either in that press conference or subsequently has emerged is that one of the things that America wants Britain to do now is to take back a lot of the British prisoners, ISIS prisoners in Syria, you know, including Shamima Begum, something like 250 of them, and saying, you know, you've got to do this for us now. Again, that would be incredibly difficult for a British government to do. So I don't think it would be a buddy-buddy relationship of equals as conceived by Elon Musk or certainly by Trump.
And do you get any impression that Musk and Trump are talking about Britain as part of their sort of international plans? Because certainly Musk's strange to a lot of people preoccupation with Britain in the recent days suggests, I mean, he's even tweeted a pinned tweet at 7 a.m. on the same day as the Trump press conference, should America liberate Britain from its tyrannical government?
Yes, that doesn't sound very friendly to me, but... yeah, no, I mean, Musk's... if I were the British government, I'm sure they are extremely concerned about this. Mm. But they have to think very carefully about how you deal with it. And it's partly because we don't know whether Musk is speaking for himself or speaking for Trump. And the question, you know, it would in a way be very good politics, I think, for Keir Starmer to take on Musk. You know, I stand up for Britain, this foreign billionaire, who is he, etc. And maybe he'll do that. But if he does, he's got to think, am I antagonizing the entire United States, the incoming government? What am I putting at risk if I do that? Mm. And I think that the other thing is, well, what are Musk's intentions? And is he further right, actually, even than Trump, when he backs the AFD, for example, which he's doing this week, when even reform is too moderate for him, and he's saying, actually, Tommy Robinson's the guy I'm interested in. Mm. At what point does that become a threat to, you know, our democracy?
Yeah, or to what extent is he the sort of useful extreme mouthpiece that Trump used to be on Twitter himself in 2016? I wonder.
But I suspect that he is showing more of an interest in the UK than Trump has ever shown. Mm. You know, Trump was you know, charmed by the Queen. He has his golf courses. He didn't think that much of Theresa May. He was always, actually, Farage was always his guy and the person he got on with. But one felt that, you know, yeah, he was sort of mildly well-disposed to some elements of British politics, but it wasn't front and centre for him.
Yeah.
Whereas I think for Musk, for whatever reason, it's his obsession of the day. Now, I mean, if I were the Brits, I would hope that there's so much on Musk's plate, you know, that eventually his interests will move off.
Yeah.
But if he's really intent on, as he sees it, winning the battle for Western civilization by changing the politics of Europe, Britain being part of it, Germany part of it, well, then, you know, that really is a challenge.
Indeed, indeed. And it seems to be Trump and Musk both think of Britain as the motherland, and so it is quite important to them. But we, being British ourselves, are getting over... we're talking too much about Britain because we should be talking about the world.
Yeah.
Because that's, after all, what Donald Trump seems to be talking about. And in this fascinating piece I mentioned earlier, you talk about America under Trump becoming a revisionist power, just as China and Russia are revisionist powers. Can you unpack a little bit of what you mean? And you say that's, it's puzzling on America's...
Yeah. I mean, I think it's puzzling because, you know, the standard critique that the Russians and the Chinese made when the Americans talked about the rules-based order is, this is just hypocrisy. It's basically a world constructed to benefit the United States and its allies. And you could say the current institutions have been sponsored by America, the World Trade Organization, you know, Clinton put his weight behind it. But going further back, the UN and so on, they're based in New York, after all. And yet here you have a US president saying, you know what, the world as currently working works very badly for America, and we're going to overturn the apple cart. And most obviously on trade, we're going to impose tariffs on everybody, but particularly on China, but potentially a 10 to 20% tariff on the whole world. And again, you'd say, well, hang on, what exactly is your problem? America is the world's largest economy. It's been growing faster than, you know, everybody else. It's currently growing almost as fast as China, a much poorer country. It dominates tech, it dominates finance. So to what extent is it working so badly for the United States? That's why, in some respects, I find it puzzling. And yet, it clearly is a proposition that Trump was able to sell to the American electorate. And now he's in power, he's going to try and reorder the world, kind of rip up a lot of the old institutions, particularly on trade, but also, and potentially threateningly for its America's allies, the relationship with U.S. allies, who he continually portrays as kind of freeloading on America, American security guarantees in Europe, but also in Asia. He said similar things about Japan, about South Korea. Now, you could have a fairly kind of... benign view of that, where he's saying, actually, he's telling us to do what we need to do anyway, which is increase defence spending. America spends something like 3.5%, but most European countries, you know, Britain's at 2.3%, France is at 2%, the Netherlands at 2%, Poland's at 4.7%, but they've got Russia right next door to them. And so we need to increase this spending. But if it's... if there's a more aggressive, still version of that, where Trump actually says, you know what, in the end, I'm not really interested in defending Europe in the way that America used to. This is a commitment that's now outdated, dates back to, you know, the 1950s. The world's moved on. We're going to concentrate on Panama and Greenland and our interests in, above all, blocking China. Then it's a really different set of questions for Europeans, particularly if it's combined with what looks like intervention in our domestic politics.
I see your point as your arguments to why it's puzzling in one sense. However, it also seems to me that it's a very natural response to the revisionist ambitions of China, because after all, what's a Trump world will say is that there is supposed to be this international rules-based order, but for a long time China has been taking great advantage of it and growing, not playing by the rules at all, and actually is becoming, this could soon be, the world's dominant superpower, and this is a reaction to stop that, and we need to behave as a revisionist power in order to stop.
Indeed, I mean, and if the revisionism were kind of reserved for China, so we're going to bang this tariff on China, and if it means kind of reneging on the WTO, don't care. That's kind of compatible with a great power move, but within the normal structures, mental structures we have of America leading the free world. But if he's simultaneously whacking Germany, the EU, Britain, etc., then that's a bit more puzzling. But we don't yet know how that's going to play out. And there are competing forces within, you know, around for Trump's ear, and probably voices, you know, in his own head about which direction to go. I think he's an improviser with some very strong instincts.
And a fair part of your piece is about tariffs, because, of course, this will be a conversation about tariffs in the next few years. Trump thinks tariffs are actually a much better idea than anybody in the establishment is willing to accept. Or the old establishment, you know, Financial Times brain, if you like, is willing to accept. Do you ever think maybe sometimes he has a point?
If you enjoy what we do here at Spectator TV, then why not subscribe to the magazine as well? If you subscribe today, you'll get 12 weeks for just £12, plus a free £20 John Lewis and Waitrose gift card. You can sign up at spectator.co.uk/TV offer.
Well, we'll see. You know, in a way, it's such an old idea that we haven't really seen it play out. I think I spent too many years being indoctrinated The Economist to go that far. So, no, I don't think it's a good idea. But I think that America can probably weather it better than, say, the UK, because America's a huge economy. So autarky is, or, you know, high tariff walls are possibly more workable for the United States. They're self-sufficient in energy. The world's largest energy producers. They produce most of their own food, etc. But they are vulnerable in certain areas. You know, they're trying to remedy their dependence on Taiwanese semiconductors, but they need them. And there are other things that that they will need. But also, I think it does raise prices. There is, you know, you can see the markets already beginning to think maybe we're going to have a new era of inflation in the United States. And I think over time it makes you less efficient. And I thought it was very interesting, actually. We're all looking at the Musk-Trump relationship and are there tensions in there. When Milei of Argentina said he was going to slash tariffs, Musk tweeted, great idea. So, you know, is that a commentary on what Trump is planning?
Yes, I suppose the hope always in many ways with Trump and tariffs is that it's a negotiating tactic. But it may be somewhere in between the two, in that it's a negotiating tactic that he takes seriously, and that he wants to be in a position where he can grant dispensation. So the tariff applies to everyone, but he is in a position to grant dispensations to whoever asks him nicely or whoever asks him in a way that benefits America.
Yeah, and obviously he sees it as a geopolitical tool as much as an economic tool. I mean, the initial argument was economic, protect industries, you know, American jobs and all of that. But it just in recent days, when he said, when he was asked, well, would you attack Canada? He said, oh, no, no, no. But we'll use tariffs to put pressure on them.
Yeah.
And he said the same about Denmark. We'll use tariffs to put pressure on them. Now, you know, tariffs, there is a, meant to be a legal structure behind them. You can't, I think, turn them on and off like a tap quite in that way.
Mm.
But sure, he's going to use them as a kind of cudgel, I think. But I also think there is a danger, then a geopolitical danger for America in that you begin to alienate allies.
Mm-hmm.
And also you look totally unreliable. So countries will, you know, the BRICS, for example, are expanding. Indonesia joined this week. The EU's just signed a big trade deal with Mercosur, which is collectively the EU and Mercosur is about 20% of the world economy, 25%. And I think the biggest risk is there are voices in the EU saying, you know what, maybe we should make a deal with China. And I think a lot of what Biden was trying to do, and quite successfully, was to work on allies to get them to take an American line on China. And so you had von der Leyen talking about de-risking from China and so on. But if Trump punches the Europeans too hard in the face, there'll be voices, there already are voices saying, well, let's just do a deal with the Chinese. You know, we need Chinese EVs and solar panels if we're going to get anywhere on the clean technology transition. The Chinese EVs are cheaper, actually, than Teslas. Let's go for it and get them to build factories in Europe. So I think that is, and if I were the Europeans and you're looking, wow, you know, Trump's looking quite threatening towards us, we need leverage, you play the China.
Mm. Well, upsetting or not upsetting allies brings us neatly onto Ukraine.
Mm.
Which will be a very big issue early on for the Trump administration. There was a sort of, when the Ukraine war started and the Western response happened, there was quite a lot of hope that the West was galvanised now, you know, militarily, and quite a lot of hawkish excitement, I'd say, about that. I think a lot of that is gone now.
Yeah.
And the question then is, does actually the world want Donald Trump to negotiate a peace? And perhaps commentators can blame him for rewarding Putin's aggression, but really it's what everybody knows has to happen.
To some extent. Look, I mean, I think that, you know, everybody should want peace. This is a war that's cost 1 million casualties, you know, Russian and Ukrainian dead and wounded. You know, I certainly don't resent his ambition to do that. The question is on what terms? I think the fear in Ukraine and in parts of Europe is that if it's a kind of peace that's sort of stop for now and no guarantees for Ukraine, that Russia would be back within a couple of years as they were back after the Crimean annexation. But, you know, we don't know. Maybe you could just freeze it in place and that wouldn't be a great result, but it would be better than... I think the vision of a Ukrainian victory, of Russia falling apart, which was this sort of real hawkish hope, and those hopes were probably at their peak when Prigozhin's rebellion was on, and people thought, wow, you know, Putin might actually be toppled and a whole new future for Russia. I think that doesn't look likely anymore. And so to that extent, there is some convergence between where the Biden administration was moving and where Trump is moving. Even the Biden people were saying, we're hoping for a negotiation next year. But I think there are two big questions about it. First, I think the Biden people, although they hadn't resolved how to do this, did take seriously the idea that Ukraine needed some kind of security guarantee, whether it was NATO, whether it was European, whether it was simply stuffing Ukraine with weapons so that they could fight back next time. That was something they were thinking about. It's not clear to me that Trump does take that bit of it that seriously. But then I think probably the biggest flaw is it's not clear that Russia's interested. Russia may decide that Ukraine is slowly losing, and if they keep going, they can get what they were after initially.
Well, and that China and Russia perhaps agree that this war is bleeding Western power, it's bleeding Western resolve, and that the longer it carries on, the better for them.
Yeah, I mean, I who knows what the Chinese really think about this? But, you know, there was a period, you know, when I was, last time I was in Kiev, when the Ukrainians were hoping that the Chinese would intervene and, you know, talk to the Russians and so on. I have an American friend who sort of does these back channel talks where he goes off and talks to the Chinese and the Russians. And I said, you know, what are they saying? And he said, they really hate each other. He said, they both are very suspicious of America and that does bring them together, but they don't get on that well. That was, you know, an observation. I don't know whether it's true. So I don't know what China's real goal is, but I think that the one thing that does unite the Russians and the Chinese is that they want an end to the West dominated world. Mm. And to that extent, China doesn't want to see a Russian defeat, and a weakened West is in its interest, yeah.
So they want to move towards multipolarity and away from American unipolarity, which is sort of what Trump is bringing them.
Yes, although, you know, it's not clear to me that that's what the people around him want, because I think they can see some of the pitfalls of that. So there's a very strong school of thought around Trump that says, you know, Russia's not the problem, China's the problem, and we have to concentrate on keeping China in its box. So Elbridge Colby, the guy they just appointed as basically chief strategist in the Pentagon, his whole argument has been, we got to pull our forces. We don't have forces to contain both Russia and China. The Europeans have got to look after Russia. We've got to pull our forces over to Asia, but not just to hand the place over to China, on the contrary, to bolster American power in the Pacific. And again, there's some continuities with what Biden was doing, albeit in a different way. But under Kirk Campbell, who was Deputy Secretary of State for a couple more days, that was the whole thrust of American policy.
Mm. And an argument that you make in this piece, or that you put forward, it's more of an analytical piece than an argumentative one, but is that China will feel emboldened to take Taiwan if Trump rewards Putin's aggression in Ukraine?
It's a possibility, certainly. I mean, you know, again, you can argue back and forth. I've had friends who say, no, it's more complicated than that. But I think the sort of central assumption is that, sure, there is such a thing as a sort of global geopolitical mood. And I think the chaotic American and allied withdrawal from Afghanistan may have contributed to Putin's sense that the West was weak and that he could move in Ukraine.
Mm.
And if Russia finally triumphs in Ukraine after the West has made this great song and dance, then maybe the Chinese will feel, well, you know, the West really is in retreat. But they have to make their own calculations. You know, invading Taiwan is not simple. Mm. And it would also involve a kind of economic rupture, which would be incredibly damaging for both China and the US.
Mm.
So do they really want to do that? I mean, possibly, unfortunately, in one parallel with Russia is that it's probably in one man's head. I mean, I think it was Putin personally who decided this was what they was going to do in Ukraine. And China is similarly centralized and people are similarly trying to figure out, well, what does she want?
Mm. And I mean, all of them are unpredictable.
Yeah.
And perhaps Trump is the most unpredictable. So for China, particularly with Taiwan, it goes back to the usual argument you had about Trump a lot in the first term, which is that people just don't know what he's going to do, and that makes him very strong.
Yes, although he is unpredictable. But he has said some things on Taiwan which suggest that he's not that interested in defending Taiwan. And, you know, again, I have a degree of sympathy with him. I mean, I like Taiwan. I think it's a marvelous place. And I think it could be a model for the future, you know, of a democratic China. Is it worth fighting World War III over? You know, maybe not. Yeah.
And perhaps the one thing that Trump is predictable about is he doesn't like walls.
No, absolutely.
Perhaps for humane reasons, but also for
value destruction. It doesn't make much sense to him. But, I mean, I think the thing is that I don't think even Western leaders, sort of current brand before Trump, knew for definite in their own minds if they'd fight over Taiwan.
Mm.
The point was to place the thought in Xi's head that we might. As some, you know, one of the American strategists pointed to me, he said, she has told China, they seem very confident of this, she has told China, the Chinese military, to be ready to invade by 2027. And our goal is that when he gets to 2027, he looks at the military balance and says, too risky, can't do it. And again, you know, an Australian strategist, when they were describing to me AUKUS and the whole, you know, what these nuclear subs are for and so on, and I sort of expressed some disquiet and said, you know, this kind of sounds like we're preparing for a massive war. And he said, nah, you know, the point is to stop a war, not to start one. But it's deterrence.
Yeah.
And whether Trump's kind of erratic statements increase deterrence or decrease them, I don't know.
Well, in your piece, you say there's sort of outline five possible scenarios of what America First foreign policy might mean for the world. And they are, I can read them out, they are, and I'm afraid I'm going to ask you to go through them. They are, one, new great power bargain.
Yeah.
How would that pan out?
So that's some of what we've been talking about, where Trump says, you know what, actually, we're not going to try to be the unipolar power. We're going to give you a sphere of influence to some degree. You know, Russia can dominate Eastern Europe. China will be more influential. But in return, I want something. And what would that thing be? Well, it would be peace, but it would also maybe be a much more kind of beneficial economic relationship with China, where they agreed to sort of buy huge amounts of American soybeans, maybe give concessions to American companies such as Tesla, who already actually operate a big plant in China. So that would be the kind of bargain where Trump uses threats as leverage, but there's a kind of an understanding with Putin and Xi. And there's some sense that, you know, Trump often speaks of them as peers that he respects, that he has that at the back of his mind.
And the big loser in that, it seems to be, would be Europe. Europe is not one of those great powers that is in the bargaining there.
No, I think Europe would be a loser, and also potentially Japan, South Korea. If it's basically middle powers that get squeezed in that sort of great power bargain. But the trouble is, it's easier to describe than to implement, because each of these countries would have a slightly different view of, well, you know, what their sphere of influence would be. And at a certain stage, the Americans might say, well, no, we didn't mean that. You know, for example, Chinese domination of Taiwan. Well, TSMC produces 90% of the world's most advanced semiconductors. No American president's going to say, fine, China can control that.
Well, the second scenario is war by accident.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably most listeners and viewers will be able to understand that. But, I mean, what would be your... what would be the immediate trigger for that?
Well, I suppose it's an extension of what I'm talking about, that they think they're reaching a great power bargain, that Trump's, you know, but that Trump's, or the America's behavior is misinterpreted, that the Russians and the Chinese think they're being given a green light to do what they want. China does try to invade Taiwan, but they've got it wrong. America comes in, and you end up in a war because both sides misunderstand where they were. And, you know, to some extent, that may have been partly what happened with Ukraine, that Putin didn't anticipate the extent of Western opposition. He did. He was correct to believe we wouldn't fight, but there was more pushback than he thought. So countries can miscalculate, and you could have a miscalculation that actually leads to war.
And then your third scenario is something that I think is sort of happening already, which is anarchy in a leaderless world.
Yeah.
Would you agree with me that that's sort of where we're drifting towards that?
Yeah, we're having more sort of failed states, I think. Sudan, you know, where there are, I think, 11 million displaced people. Myanmar in Asia, which is turning into what Syria was, maybe still is, you know, a place where the government, central government, only controls about a third of the territory, and there are various groups that none of us can name, but fighting it out. But there are refugees, there's drugs, there are outside powers intervening, but not enough to actually restore order. And you'll maybe get more of that because America's lost its appetite, as has the West, for intervention after Afghanistan, after Iraq. China is not ready for it. Russia does, but in a very destructive way through Wagner. So, I think that some of that is already happening.
And then your fourth one strikes me as dreamy, slightly. Globalization without America, because I mean, this would be the kind of BRIC hope that developing powers will be strong enough to have a sort of global economy without America controlling it. But, I mean, America is the driving force of global capitalism. Can that really happen?
Well, not completely without America, but more of it. So I pointed to the EU-Mercosur agreement. That's something, I think, a closer EU-China relationship. And although you say it's dreamy, one should remember that there are more countries whose major trading partner is China than whose major trading partner is the United States. Yeah. So sitting in Europe, it seems dreamy. But if you're sitting in Southeast Asia, maybe it's kind of already happened.
Yeah, I said dreamy. Maybe I meant nightmare-y. I think it's more nightmare-y.
I mean, I think that it's nightmare-y if it's accompanied by an expansion of Chinese geopolitical and Russian geopolitical influence. If it can be confined to what Osborne would have referred to as the Golden Age, where you just do a lot more trade, but it doesn't have political implications, maybe it's a way out.
Yes, I mean, I suppose the sort of the old conservative concerns about freedom would be, you know, that would be the big concern, is that freedom would be diminished quite drastically in such a world.
Yes.
Freedom of speech and so on.
Well, that's if it does have political implications. I mean, if by trading with China, and I think it's a legitimate concern, you place yourself on the hook where they say, as in a way Elon Musk is saying, yeah, well, that's fine, but we actually don't like what you're doing, you know, this newspaper article you published about us, so can you kind of do something about that? Then that is very concerning. But if you stop short of that, but you just have an expansion of trade, then it does mean that you're not going to push back against China about human rights inside China. But we don't do that much of it anyway. But maybe you expand economic relations with that. But I think the problem with that is, certainly for Britain, maybe less for Asian countries, is that I don't think America would take it lying down. They wouldn't say, well, fine. They would get quite shirty about it.
Yes, yeah. Which brings us to the last scenario, which is America, dreamy for some, nightmare for others. America first succeeds.
Yeah.
What do you think the likelihood of that is? I mean, I suppose the argument there would be America really is in the bully pulpit. America first can change the world to its own liking.
They have enormous power tools, no doubt about it. They've got the world's reserve currency, they're the world's leaders in tech, and they are the world's predominant military power, and basically underpin the security arrangements of both Europe and Asia. And one of the reasons European countries, maybe the primary reasons European countries don't turn around and, you know, say something very rude to Donald Trump, is they're acutely conscious of their continuing dependence on American security guarantees. So, he might be able to get a lot of what he wanted through, you know, Biden attempted to do it through sweet-talking allies and saying, you know, this is what the way we're going to counterbalance China is by rebuilding alliances. But Trump is going to say, you know, well, we don't have time for these kinds of conversations. We're going to decide what we want to do, and you're going to come along with us. And maybe it'll work for a while.
Do you, I mean, if it did succeed, would you think that the liberal world order had ended?
It depends what's accompanied by it. But if it's a, if you have the collapse of NATO, the collapse of the World Trade Organization, and the US actively intervening in the elections of fellow democracies, then yes, I would.
But if it checks the ascent of China, if it means freedom of speech is protected, if it means that economies can thrive, I mean, Trump is pro-business. Why would it be bad news?
Well, I don't think it's great if the world's richest man, who's also a close ally of the US president, is calling for the overthrow of the British government. You know, China, even China doesn't do that. I mean, are we looking at the wrong place, you know, in terms of us as a self-respecting democracy?
Well, he notably doesn't do it about China, of course.
Absolutely.
Elon Musk, which does tell you quite a lot, I think. But I think for a lot of Republicans, they would regard America First Succeeding as a chance to save the world from a kind of descent into this anarchy that we were talking about, that is benefiting or that has benefited authoritarian states, revisionist powers, and, you know, tyranny.
Yeah, except that, you know, we're at a balanced... I don't think we're quite there yet. You know, I actually don't think that Russia and China are yet at the point that they would like to be, which is dominating their regions. You know, as Jake Sullivan said in an effort to defend Biden's record, he said, you know, let's say as a thought experiment that America had decided to invade Canada. Maybe it will decide to invade. And that, you know, he's talking about Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and that 3 years in, the US had lost 700,000 troops and was, you know, at Manitoba and nowhere near, you know, you wouldn't say that was a success. And similarly, actually, China, maybe we've reached peak China before they've been able, they've taken over Hong Kong, but not Taiwan. The Chinese economy is in trouble. They've got a big demographic problem. And actually, another element of the whole America First Succeed scenario is possibly these punitive tariffs on China will really throw China into a crisis. It's, you know, Chinese economists have estimated it might knock 2% off their GDP growth from 5 to 3. That's not great for them. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, put it this, we're kind of getting lost in various scenarios, but I don't think that it's necessary for America to strong arm its allies because the situation is so hopelessly lost with Russia and China that it's Trump's way or descent into tyranny. That's not the world I see.
Yeah, well, you conclude, I'm sure rightly, with this point that it's probably going to be some amalgam of all these scenarios.
Yeah.
And you quote the great Gramsci quote, but you do the full version, which is because the second part is the key bit, I think. The old world is dying and the new world cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear.
Well, thank you for saying that, because I hesitated and I thought, this is a terrible cliche. Can I really end on it?
But you do the full one.
But it did, I did put famous, I cliched, quote by Gramsci, because it does seem very appropriate, actually. And it's interesting, yes. When he was writing in 1929 as a world order was breaking down. And indeed, we did get quite a few morbid symptoms in the 1930s.
Things are cliches for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gideon Rackman, thank you very much for coming to The Spectator.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to that episode of Americano. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please leave a review on whatever platform you are watching or listening into it on. We prefer positive reviews, although some constructive criticism is also welcome. I'd also urge you to sign up to the Americano newsletter, which I write every week. It comes out on Thursdays, and people seem to be enjoying it so far. Thank you very much to the audience. Thanks also to my producer, Natasha Feroz, for doing such a wonderful job. And speak to you next time.